This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. Ted Stevens is out. Joe Lieberman stays in. Tom Daschle's back in the fold. But really, what everyone wants to know is Hillary Clinton, Madam Secretary, or staying a senator? It is Wednesday, and it's our time for our weekly dose of the political junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
I love those hockey moms. You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick.
But I'm the decider.
On Wednesday, NPR's political editor Ken Rudin joins us to talk about all the latest political news from Washington to Wasilla. The transition, the recount, the runoff, and the race is still too close to call. Later, we'll discuss Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, and should Barack Obama go off the grid and give up his BlackBerry? Ken Rudin joins us here in Studio 3A. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Allison.
I'm prepared. The staff has prepared me that there is a trivia question today.
There is. It only takes about 45 minutes of the show. Okay. John McCain has filed paperwork to allow him to run for Senate if he chooses in 2010 for re-election. Who was the last senator to run for president who was defeated in his next bid for re-election to the Senate?
All right. One more time.
Okay. So John McCain, who ran for president and lost, and he's going to run for, he's a senator. Who was the last senator who ran for president and lost, and after that defeat was defeated in his bid for re-election to the Senate?
All right. So who was the two-time loser?
Right.
Is the shorthand.
Right.
If you think you know the last senator to run for president who was defeated in his next bid for re-election to the Senate, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. The email is talk@npr.org. It's been a busy day in politics already today. Tom Daschle, former Senate Majority Leader, what's his new job going to be?
Well, it's been confirmed that he has been offered the job of Health and Human Services Secretary in the Obama cabinet, and he has accepted. It's been confirmed by NPR's Don Gagne. So he was once originally thought to be the next chief of staff when Rahm Emanuel got that position. Everybody knew that Daschle would get a position. He was an early Obama supporter. You know, it was very strong with him, with members of Congress, and apparently he'll be HHS Secretary.
Does he have a level of expertise here?
He's really strong on health policy, okay. And he always, matter of fact, even if he wasn't offered this, everybody thought that he would be the health care czar in the new administration, but apparently he'll be Secretary as well.
And John Boehner, he's had a good day as well?
Well, he didn't have a good day a couple of weeks ago when under his leadership, the Republican Party lost at least 20 seats in the House.
Yeah.
2 years ago, they lost 30 seats in the House, but somehow he survives. There was not a major challenge to his post as House Minority Leader. Dan Lundgren, a Republican of California, conservative, made a symbolic attempt to beat him. It was not even close. Boehner lives.
All right. And Eric Holder apparently has been tapped to be the attorney general for Barack Obama. Again, this is one of these leaks that has come out of who's going to be in the cabinet, who are going to be appointees. Was this a surprise to you about Eric Holder?
Well, this has not been confirmed. We don't have it confirmed, but he was always on the short list. Eric Holder would be, of course, the first African-American to be attorney general. And a lot of people have talked about his role in the Mark Rich pardon in the latter days of the Bill Clinton administration, where he perhaps did not vet that decision strongly enough. But
also, because he was deputy attorney general to Janet Reno, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
In the administration. But I don't think anybody feels that that's going to hold him back at all, nor should it. He's highly thought of, very smart, and from the beginning he was likely to be a position like that, and attorney general is one of them. Of course, we also have to mention Joe Lieberman.
Oh, yes.
Which happened yesterday. The Senate Democrats, in secret vote, now this is very interesting, 42-13 was the vote. They decided not to strip him of his Homeland Security Committee. And what's interesting about that is that, of course, in a secret vote, you thought there'd be more people, more Democrats in the Senate who were upset that he not only endorsed John McCain for president, but criticized the Democratic nominee, Barack Obama.
But Senator Majority Leader Harry Reid, he sort of intimated at his press conference that people, Democrats, maybe they still have some questions about what Senator Lieberman did. Let's listen to Senator Reid and then Senator Lieberman.
We're moving forward, recognizing that there is a period of time that
in Joe Lieberman's political career that I will never understand or approve.
Some of the things that people have said I said about Senator Obama are simply not true. There are other statements that I made that I wish I had made more clearly. And there are some that I made that I wish I had not made at all. And obviously in the heat of campaigns, that happens to all of us, but I regret that. And now it's time to move on.
Never understand or approve. Is this a forgive but not forget moment?
Well, I think it started because Barack Obama said we should look forward. There should be no recriminations. What happened in the election has passed. We're going to, you know, a new start. And I think the Senate Democrats follow that up. But Connecticut Democrats back home are not so forgiving. On December 17th, there's going to be a motion to censure Joe Lieberman. Of course, he's no longer a Democrat in Connecticut. He was reelected in 2006 as an independent, having lost the Democratic primary. But they're going to censure him and perhaps ask him to resign as a, you know, resign from the party, assuming he's still a member of the Democratic Party.
And there was also some concern that if they did take away his Homeland Security chairmanship, that he might become a Republican and that the Democrats are so close to getting 60, to being filibuster-proof.
Well, that would have been a disastrous thing for the Democrats 2 years ago had he decided to become a Republican after his 2006 victory, because then it would have kept the Senate in Republican hands. Now they're approaching 58. They have 58 right now. If they win Minnesota, it's 59. If they win Georgia runoff, it's 60.
And we should explain to people why they have 58. Because
they have 58 because Ted Stevens, yesterday on his 85th birthday, he got a very unhappy birthday present. He was decided. Mark Begich, the Democratic mayor of Anchorage, Alaska, has a 3,724 vote lead with only 2,500 votes yet still to be counted. And so we have declared Mark Begich the winner in that Alaska Senate race. He's the first Democrat to win a Senate race there since 1974. Ted Stevens, the longest Senate Republican senator in history, and Ted Stevens' career is over.
We have a little bit of Mark Begich on what perhaps was a stumbling block for Senator Stevens.
People were concerned about where are we going to be as a state 30, 40 years from now, and who can bring us down that path. And I think in the case of Ted Stevens, they were concerned that maybe he would not be able to do that because of his personal challenges that he had in front of him.
Is that the euphemism, personal challenges for convicted felon?
Mark Begich was very magnanimous about that. Yes, a 7 counts convicted felon. And what, of course, that means is that Ted Stevens will not be reelected, and that means that he will not resign a seat. And the political junkie fantasy, of course, not my personal fantasy, but that Sarah Palin runs for that special seat and comes to Washington and tortures all the senators who tortured her during the campaign. So Mark Begich, the first Democrat in many decades representing Alaska in the U.S. Senate.
Mike Gravel giving a fist pump somewhere?
The last one was Mike Gravel. Exactly.
Well, since we're talking about senators losing their seats, should we go back to your trivia question?
Okay.
All right. The question was, name the last senator to run for president who was defeated in his next bid for reelection to the Senate. Let's talk to Richard in San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
What do you think the answer is? Who do you think the answer is?
Walter Mondale.
Well, actually, no, Walter Mondale was not only a former senator, but he was a former vice president when he ran for president in 1984. We're talking about an incumbent senator who sought the presidency, like Bobby Kennedy, of course. Bobby Kennedy was not defeated. He was assassinated. Hillary Clinton is a senator who ran for president. John McCain is a senator who ran for president.
All right.
Well, not a former.
Go back to the Google, Richard.
Okay.
And there are two answers, by the way. There were two answers
two
to this
answers.
Question. Yes.
All right. Well, let's let Victoria from Denver try. Hi, Victoria.
Hi.
Who do you think this is?
Well, it's a total guess. I'm in my car, so I didn't get to Google anything. But my guess is Bob Dole.
Well, actually, no, Bob Dole has never been defeated for the Senate. When he ran for president in 1996, he resigned his Senate seat after he won the Republican nomination. He thought that dismissing his Senate career might give the voters a new look at him, but he was never defeated for the Senate. He resigned his Senate seat that year.
Victoria, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Now, we have two Senate races that are still undecided at this point.
We do. One is in Georgia. There's a runoff on December 2nd. Bill Clinton is in Georgia today campaigning for the Democratic nominee Jim Martin. Al Gore will be in Georgia on Sunday on behalf of Martin. The reason there's a runoff is because Georgia law says you must get 50% of the vote plus one. Saxby Chambliss got 49.8% of the vote. He's the Republican incumbent. Jim Martin fell about 100,000 votes behind. Mitt Romney will be campaigning on behalf of Saxby Chambliss on Friday. It's almost like a Spanish Civil War. The big powers are taking sides between Chambliss and Martin, and it's going to be a very important race.
And now in Minnesota, they're just counting at this point.
They start
by
today.
Hand
count, 2.9 million votes. Only 206 votes separate the Republican incumbent Norm Coleman, who declared victory yesterday. Very interesting, because it's hardly over. And Democrat Al Franken, 206 votes as of now, separates the two candidates.
All right. Should we try to see if we can find somebody who knows the answer to this question? If you think you know the last senator to run for president who was defeated in his next bid for reelection to the Senate, we're going to go to caller number five. Caller number five, you're Scott. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
Where are you calling from?
Nampa, Idaho.
You're calling from Idaho.
Ooh.
All right.
Ooh.
Ken is smiling. Go ahead, Scott.
How about Frank Church?
Well, Frank Church is one of the two answers. Frank Church is a Democrat who ran for president in 1976, Democratic primaries, and was defeated in the Reagan Revolution in 1980. He lost his seat. There's somebody else, another Democrat, who also ran for president in 1976 and was defeated in 1980. But Frank, along with Frank Church, that is the correct answer.
Scott, you have bragging rights for the day.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! Thanks a lot for
We always should.
I can tell you that.
We should also always separate Church from Scott. The expression.
You can use that one today, Scott, if you like. Thanks for calling. You want to tell us who the other person is?
The other answer is Birch Bayh of Indiana, Evan Bayh's father.
Father.
It's funny that we now know him as Evan
right.
Bayh's father.
Yeah.
But Birch Bayh ran for the Democratic nomination in 76, defeated by Dan Quayle in 1980 in Indiana.
Ken Rudin is NPR's political editor here with us in Studio 3A. You can read his column and download his podcast at npr.org. We are going to talk more with Ken, our political junkie, in a moment. But up next, we'll discuss what do we know about Hillary Clinton being the next Secretary of State. I'm Allison Stewart. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Take over this beautiful land. And take over this beautiful land. And take over this beautiful land.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington. We're speaking with Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and our political junkie every Wednesday. So we're going to just dive into the story that everybody's talking about. We're going to spend the rest of the segment discussing all that is being discussed around Senator Hillary Clinton, that she could become Madam Secretary, Secretary of State. Now, here's a bigger question for you. What role do you think that Senator Hillary Clinton should play or could play in the Obama administration, if any role at all? Tell us why. 800-989-8255. Email us also at talk@npr.org. On the line now, we have Washington Post reporter Ann Kornblut. She covered the presidential election, is now writing a book about Hillary Clinton. She joins us on the phone from her home here in Washington, where I understand you're a little bit under the weather, so you're a real trooper for joining us. Hi, Ann.
Hi, thank you.
So, Ann, tell us, why would Senator Clinton want this job of Secretary of State?
Well, I should first correct the record and say I'm not writing a book about Clinton, per se, but about women in 2008. But I can tell you, having covered her, that she would want an executive job that would present a lot of new challenges different from her day-to-day job as a senator, although her aides have been careful to say that she likes it. It's obviously a lot less interesting. There's no guarantee that she would get to do health care if she were to stay. And being Secretary of State comes with a big coterie and a lot of attention around the world, and would give her kind of a place to play out the star power that she built up during the campaign, as opposed to being just one of 100 senators.
Now, why do you think Barack Obama would offer it to her?
Well, from what we understand, he views her as obviously somebody who knows a lot about the world, who would give instant name recognition to that job. There are some people close to the Obama circle who think it would be a way of co-opting her and her husband. But there's no way, I certainly have no evidence that that is his thinking, but that he'd bring together a team of rivals. We've talked about it a lot over the last few weeks, but that he really does like people who have different points of view. and is confident enough in his own leadership abilities that he wouldn't be threatened by having somebody of her stature on his cabinet.
Ken, let me bring you into this. Why would you think Senator Hillary Clinton, who spent so much time trying to establish herself as a senator, came in, went right to work, put her nose to the grindstone, didn't seek the limelight, really dug in? I mean, I'm from New York. She really dug in to her work as a senator. Why would she give that up, that perhaps an incredible career in the Senate, to be Secretary of State?
Well, if some people buy the argument that the only reason she ran for the Senate in 2000 was as a stepping stone to the presidency. And so by doing that, she was elected in 2000, reelected in 2006, and she made her bid in 2008. Right now, she's only 34th in seniority. Perhaps, you know, as Ann said, that maybe she just, you know, she's not going to move up. She's not going to have the responsibility for health care that she so much wants. Now, some people say that she could do, Hillary Clinton could do what Ted Kennedy did, ran for president in 1980, decided it was not didn't work, and then became a lifer. He dedicated his entire career to pushing issues like that across, you know, in the Senate. But you know, again, the fact is there are 33 Democrats ahead of her in the seniority thing, and perhaps she has an opportunity to go out. She'll be 69 years old if Barack Obama finishes two terms. Perhaps maybe this is the way she wants to be most remembered.
Now, Ann, you've been covering the presidential election, and from all the reporters who have, we all know it's the Obama camp is called No Drama Obama. That's sort of his mantra. Let's keep the steady ship, keep it going. Yet this story is leaked out and kind of taken on a little bit of a life of its own. Why is this playing out so publicly, Anne?
Well, it's a really interesting question, and there's no question about it. I mean, I think we've heard some complaints from Obama loyalists and even some Obama advisors about how rapidly every detail of the Clinton interaction in this process has leaked. That's just sort of the way the Clintons operate in general. There's been some differences of opinion, too, sort of different descriptions. You know, we have a Clinton aide telling us today that she was offered the job, when, in fact, Obama aides are saying that it wasn't a formal offer, that they've said that she would probably be offered it if she could pass the vet, and they expect her to accept it. So there's some daylight between the two sides now, and this is often the way it is with the Clintons, because it is such a big operation and they're such a very chatty group. But so far, the Obama campaign has not said that that would be a deal breaker for them. Presumably, they understood that that was what they were getting. They ran against her and her people for a long time. They know them very well. And so far, that does not seem to be diminishing her chances of actually winding up with the job.
And the question of vetting seems to be less about Hillary Clinton and more about Bill Clinton, his presidential library, his international financial deals. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, he would undergo the same, is undergoing, in fact, the same kind of vetting that any spouse of anyone who would be up for that kind of a cabinet position would. His is obviously a lot more high profile and could be more significant because so much of his work is international and he's paid by foreign entities to do the work that he does, including just a few days ago getting a ton of money to speak in Kuwait. So lawyers on both sides are going through all of this now and looking to see if there would be any kind of potential conflict. He has apparently also agreed to air any of his future dealings with the State Department if she were to get the job. But I'm told by Obama advisors that that is standard operating procedure. That would be the same for any spouse of any Secretary of State.
And the donors to his presidential library, too, he may reveal those names if
some of those names, if they reach a certain status, not all of them. Apparently, there's still some haggling back and forth, you know, with Clinton putting some parameters on what he would disclose, but not so much so that it would preclude her from getting the job. What we were told earlier today is that he will disclose what he needs to disclose, and that if she decides not to do this job, it will be her own decision, not because he did not cooperate.
And I do want to let some of our listeners weigh in here. Paul wrote to us via email, "I personally think if she takes a cabinet post, she will remain in Bill Clinton's shadow. I think the Dem Party owes her for her support of Obama in the election and that she should demand some serious, quote, affirmative action by having her select which committee she would like to chair, despite her being the junior senator from New York. If the Democrats will let Lieberman keep his post, then she should be offered one as well." Let's also talk to Stephen. Stephen's joining us from Oakland, California. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Glad to be on. I think Hillary should be appointed to the Supreme Court.
Why do you think that?
Because she's an attorney and she's had a lot of national perspective for many years, and I think she has enough of a background.
You would rather see her as a lifelong justice than in the administration?
Yes.
All right, Stephen, thanks for calling in. You know, that was floated around a little bit right after Hillary Clinton lost the nomination to Barack Obama, that possibly she would be on the Supreme Court. And are there any teeth to those rumors?
Well, he's a long way from actually appointing anybody to the Supreme Court. So when that was being talked about, it was strictly in the realm of hypothetical. You
sure.
know, he's now sitting down trying to look at actual names. It's kind of hard to see. It wouldn't really suit her character. She likes being in the public eye, and she's clearly reveled in the attention that the presidential campaign brought her. It wouldn't give her the same kind of immediacy. And as Ken alluded to before, you know, the nose to the grindstone in the Senate really was just a stepping stool to run for president. She has not been one to sort of enjoy just burrowing down and not having any attention the way a Supreme Court justice does. So it's an easier leap, I think, to see her in the Secretary of State role because of that kind of profile.
Now, for a short time when Bill Clinton was running for president, he told voters he'd get two for the price of one if he was elected. So does this mean Barack Obama might be getting two for the price of one? I remember hearing Zbigniew Brzezinski say, the problem with having Hillary as vice president is then you have three people who want to be president.
And he wasn't the only one who said that. I mean, it was one of the concerns. It's been a very interesting shift since the vice presidential selection process, because at that time we were all told by the Obama people in no uncertain terms she wouldn't have passed the vet there. They had too many, because of the opposition research they had done, they had too many concerns about his work and the way he would function to consider putting her on the ticket. Obviously something has changed since then, and they also have said that the standards are somewhat lower for the Secretary of State, that having him as the spouse of a Secretary of State wouldn't be all that different from having him as the spouse of a New York senator.
We're speaking to Ann Kornblut of The Washington Post and also Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor, about the possibility of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. It's a possibility that Carolyn from Chicago, Carolyn, you're not into that, are you?
No, I am not into that. I think that the Obama administration is supposed to look for the new 21st century type of ethics and transparency and integrity. The Clintons, in their more than 25 years in public life, have had a lot of dealings that are less than morally of the highest ground, okay? They have not exactly been at the forefront of honesty, integrity, and transparency. And I think that this country do not now need a Secretary of State who the whole world saw her lie. The whole world saw her stand up in front of her daughter and everyone else and told a lie, which she never apologized for. And that's not the type of integrity you need for someone who would be the Secretary of State. I think if the Obama administration is about a new type of statesman or stateswoman, they need to select someone who is in sync with the integrity of the Obamas.
Carolyn,
President-elect Obama has made an effort to be high in his moral dealings, him and his wife.
Yes. Carolyn from Chicago, thank you so much for your opinion, Carolyn. Is having Hillary Clinton in his cabinet, does that go against the Obama brand, Ann?
Well, I mean, it's change insofar as being magnanimous towards someone that he defeated. So in that sense, it is something different. But, you know, we're hearing a lot of complaints from Obama loyalists about the makeup of the cabinet and his staff so far that is extremely Clinton-heavy. And it's interesting that he's chosen in the first, one of the first weeks of his being president-elect to allow this to be the focus. Really, for about a week now, the focus has been entirely on Senator Clinton. So I suspect that at some point in the not-too-distant future, we'll see him and his aides trying to change the subject onto something away from the Clintons, onto something more Obama-specific.
You've got an email from Malia. We're assuming it's not Malia Obama. It says, though I love the idea of Hillary as Secretary of State, I feel that she's one of the most powerful and proactive voices for women's rights in the Senate. I hope she can stay in the Senate and continue to work for families of 9/11 victims and first responders, women's rights, and health care. When all is said and done, I've always loved the wonk in her, and I'd like to see her on the Supreme Court as well. It's interesting about the health care issue because Ted Kennedy he announced plans for this new health care legislation, and he's asked her to work on it. Now, if health care is near and dear to her heart, wouldn't it be the right choice or a good choice to stay in the Senate and work on the health care issue that way?
Well, it's a really interesting question, because by taking this job, she would be basically giving that up as something she would work on, health care, domestic women's rights. I mean, all the domestic issues that she has talked about on the campaign trail, that would be over. So it was an interesting decision to have him give her that. On the other hand, it's not something that's irrevocable. If she does go to the Secretary of State position, someone else can do it. If she stays, which I think is probably a diminishing possibility at this point, but if she stays, she'd have that there. I think there's no question that she'd have competition for health care. She's not the only one in the Senate who would want to do it. Ted Kennedy, although he's been ill, is still in charge of it. And there are other senators, too, who hold it dear to their hearts. So I think the clearer shot to having turf that really is her own would be the Secretary of State one.
And, Ken, a question for you. I mean, obviously we're talking about the person who is going to be the spokesperson for foreign policy for the president. They were so far apart on Iraq during the primary. She voted for Iraq, and Barack Obama, quite a bit of his campaigning early on, was obviously, I'm against the war in Iraq. I wouldn't have sanctioned the war in Iraq.
Well, he did say that I had the judgment to vote against, to oppose the war from the beginning, but I don't think that they were really that far apart on the war for the longest time. And also, look who he picked for vice president. Joe Biden was even more of a champion of the war, I think, than Hillary Clinton was. And I wonder if Hillary Clinton really would be one of 100 in the Senate, because she will always be the former first lady. She will always be a nationally known person. But I just wonder, though, if she doesn't get the position of Secretary of State, either she's turned it down or Barack Obama doesn't offer it. And Anne, I'm asking you this question, too. Do you think that the bad blood that we saw between the so-called Hillary people and the Obama people, might that continue or might that come to the surface again?
I think it's a really open question. I mean, it certainly persisted until 2 weeks ago. Heard from a lot of Clinton people who were upset that Obama hadn't done more to help her retire her debt. Many of them were very upset that she didn't even get vetted for the vice presidential position. So, you know, it's not as though it all went away at the convention. We've felt it, until recent days. Now, whether this would be enough to placate them or whether there would be an ongoing rivalry, I don't think we know. It's hard. They're such large looming operations, I think it's hard to know. But I think it's a valid question. I think it's one that they've got to both be asking themselves at this point.
You are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're speaking with Anne Kornblut, political reporter for The Washington Post, and Ken Rudin, political editor for NPR News, about the possibility of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. Let's talk to Ken in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Good
Hi,
afternoon.
Ken.
Terrific show you have here.
Thanks.
Yeah, she tried to defeat Hillary Clinton, did Barack, on a foreign policy platform at the end there that fell flat on its face as far as not talking to your enemies and keeping up that blustery Cold War attitude that the Republicans like. And for that alone, I don't think she deserves it, and I don't think she's going to get it. And another issue why I don't believe she would get Secretary of State is kind of a machismo thing around the world. I feel that Condi Rice was kind of marginalized over in the Middle East by the Middle East dignitaries. And for that reason, you know, I know that it's not prevalent here in America, that attitude, but overseas in a lot of countries it is. And I think she can serve a better purpose at home.
Ken from Fort Lauderdale. Thanks, Ken.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Anne, is there something to this idea that the president and his secretary of state need to be in lockstep about foreign policy, that this person has got to be going out there to the world and being the spokesperson for this president, not somebody with their own ideas and their own foreign policy agenda?
Well, I think absolutely that is traditionally the case. It would have to be the case. Effective secretaries of state are ones that foreign leaders know that they are speaking directly to the president or to somebody who has the authority to make decisions on behalf of the president. So I think if she were to take the job and travel around the world, that the expectation would be that she would be conveying Barack Obama's foreign policy, not her own. And if that weren't the case, I would not expect him to leave her in the job. On the question of women in that role, if she takes it, she'd be the third. And I think although people have debated the effectiveness of both Madeleine Albright and Condi Rice, there's very little to suggest that gender is the reason and not other things that had to do with the way they did the job.
Ann Kornblut covered the presidential election for The Washington Post. She's now writing a book about women and the election cycle in 2008. Ann, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ken Rudin is NPR's political editor. He joined us in Studio 3A. You can read his column, download his podcast at npr.org. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Allison.
Up next, unplugging the president. Should Barack Obama hang on to his BlackBerry? Stay with us. I'm Allison Stewart. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now think back a minute to the great BlackBerry blackout of 07. We all had to come to terms with our paralyzing dependence on those addictive instruments of communication. Some rejoiced, some wept. One Rutgers professor went so far as to declare that a BlackBerry addiction was, quote, similar to drugs, lending a bit of academic reasoning to the nickname CrackBerry. When the servers whirred back online, we all put our heads down, looked at our BlackBerries, and gave thanks. Now imagine that you are President-elect Barack Obama, and that blackout is about to be extended to 4 years. He has been told he should give up his faithful BlackBerry. Now, email can't be secured enough for the president, is the argument, and the Presidential Records Act make all his communications part of the official record and up for public scrutiny at some point. If you think that Mr. Obama should be able to keep his trusty handheld, tell us why. Or if you think he just needs to let it go, we want to hear from you, too. Our number here in Washington is 1-800-989-8255. You can always email us, you know, from your BlackBerry, at talk@npr.org. One reporter that believes Obama should not be forced to unplug is Jonathan Alter. He's a senior editor and columnist for Newsweek magazine, joining us from our New York bureau. And he's also my friend, full disclosure. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Allison.
So why can't he just be on good old-fashioned email? Why does he have to have the BlackBerry?
Well, because, first of all, you know, presidents do travel a lot. And I guess, you know, good old-fashioned email is better than nothing. They took that away from George W. Bush when he became president, and we saw how that ended up. You know, he was cut off from all of his old friends. Some of whom may have warned him away in ways that could have kept him out of some trouble, kept him from driving the country over a cliff. You know, a lot of times the biggest problem that a president has is isolation. And a lot of former aides and political scientists have written about this over the years, that it's extremely important to have your old friends and people you've known for a long time have some access to you beyond a Christmas card or, you know, seeing you a couple times a year at a White House reception. And email allows that, and certainly, you know, a BlackBerry, I think, could be secured. I think if they're talking about taking away his BlackBerry, they might be talking about taking away his email as well.
Tell me a little bit more about this presidential bubble that presidents find themselves in.
Well, it's just very disorienting because not only do you not have to obey any traffic rules and is it hard to go outside, which is a kind of a strange concept when, you know, you can no longer walk down the street without being mobbed. But you're surrounded by people who, even if they tell you they're not yes men and women, are to a certain extent. They're gonna feed you what they think you want to hear. Obama actually was very cognizant of this at the start and very concerned when he first decided to run for president that he not get too isolated in the bubble. And that's one reason why he's maintained a very active BlackBerry, you know, email relationship with a fairly significant number of people who've known him for many years. He doesn't usually say much from his end beyond, you know, go White Sox or thanks. And that's one reason why, to my mind, there is no security concern because the worst that could happen if it wasn't secured, if his BlackBerry was hacked into, is that some foreign government, some spies would find out what some of his old friends from Chicago were advising him to do. They wouldn't find out anything classified or anything that he was saying, because he's long since given up, been smart enough not to put anything that could be compromising in any emails of any kind. That's a lesson that anybody who works in an office should have learned a long time ago. So to me, the security implications of this are zero. It's just a totally bogus security issue, but it's symbolic of what happens when you go into the bubble. It's a bunch of people come to you and say, look, Mr. President, your life is not the same. You've got to do it this way, that way. This is the way it's going to be from now on for, quote, security reasons. And it's up to the president, and President Bush wasn't strong enough to do this, to say, hell no. You know, I'm going to continue to do it this way. And if there are security reasons, you better convince me why they are genuine security reasons. I'm not just going to take it on your say-so.
We're talking about Barack Obama. You may have seen an article in the New York Times over the weekend saying that he might have to give up his BlackBerry. Jonathan Alter from Newsweek has written an article saying, no, you know what? Let him keep his BlackBerry. Why he needs to stay plugged in. Let's go to Mark in Rochester. Hi, Mark.
Yes, right here.
First of all, do you have a BlackBerry?
Yes, I do.
Do you love your BlackBerry?
Absolutely. 7100 model. Love it.
What happened? What would you do if someone took it away from you?
Get another one.
So what do you think should happen for the president-elect and his BlackBerry?
The technology that the NSA and the CIA have, as well as the carriers have, there's encryption software that can completely disguise any transmissions. I've done it with Homeland Security. I've done it for the medical and the EMS divisions. I own a communications company here in Rochester, New York, and I've also done it for the New York State troopers that took down the Lackawanna 7 out of Buffalo for the terrorists. You may remember that.
Wow, yeah.
Believe it. Yes.
All right, Mark in Rochester, thank you so much. Let's go to Nate in Kansas City. Hey, Nate.
Hello.
Okay, Nate in Kansas, sorry.
I'm not sure I understand why he would have to give up his personal communication just because he's president.
Ah, well, I'll let Jonathan answer that.
Well, you're absolutely right. There is no reason beyond, some bureaucrat or feeling like he needs to be, very self-important and advising him that he can no longer do it. As we heard from Mark in Buffalo, there is technology available, encryption technology, that could make it secure in the same way that a president's telephone calls are perfectly secure and have been for years. So, to me, this is an example of – it's really sort of a non-issue, and it's an example of the kinds of things that come up when you do go in the bubble, because it's always easier to say no than to say yes in a strange way when it comes to national security issues of all kinds. It's one of the reasons why the whole eavesdropping thing got out of hand, because if there was a question of do we eavesdrop or not – the safe answer would always be eavesdrop. When it comes to a question of can we secure the president's communication or not, the safe answer is, well, have him not use a BlackBerry. It's up to the president, and he hasn't made a decision on this, by the way. It's not like he's agreed to have his BlackBerry taken away. It's up in the air right now. But it's up to him to say, no, I'm going to keep my BlackBerry, and that should then set a tone for some other things. Now, when it comes to his physical safety, there he needs to defer to the Secret Service. But when it comes to sort of these bogus national security claims, he needs to be, rather contrary in raising objections. There's been a lot of talk about Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt. And one of the things that made both of them successful is Lincoln believed in what he called a public opinion bath. He would fling open the doors of the White House and have all kinds of people in to tell him what they thought of what he was doing. Now, you can't do that anymore to the same extent, but the spirit of that was right. And Franklin Roosevelt was the same way. He would drive around in his hand-controlled car around rural Georgia talking to farmers and other people and finding out what was on their minds, and always had time for old friends who wanted to come in for brief chats in the White House.
So it was a reality check.
Yeah, you've got to have that if you're president. And a BlackBerry is just another tool for helping you break down the isolation that is the most crippling part of being president.
Let's go to Kurt in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. Functionality aside, just from working like a cell phone, isn't really the purpose of that large presidential entourage-like staff that we're paying for, isn't that kind of their purpose, to do what the BlackBerry does, to coordinate all that information and manage, his scheduling or his appointment?
Well, that's what they think, But the problem is, and yes, it's very important to have people like a chief of staff who control the paper flow so that you're not just besieged with memos, control his appointment schedule so that he's not overscheduled, control the telephone calls. But the thing about email is that it's a wonderful invention because, and this is why, Bill Gates has an email that's open to, lots and lots of people, is that you can ignore it when you want to, and you can kind of control your own flow, by not opening the email. And you have an opportunity to kind of manage your own relationships with other people in a much, much more efficient way. And who would want somebody else to do that? It's like every so often you run into older executives who say, well, I've got my assistant is handling my email. Well, that's generally not going to be, that's not a confidence-inspiring executive. You want somebody who's got their own email and got their own, access to lots of different forms of information so they can break down the chain of command. If you just let the chain of command dominate, you will get in trouble. You've got to circumvent the chain of command in all sorts of ways to find out what's going on in your own organization, whether you're running the PTA or the United States of America.
So he should live up to his code name, Renegade, is what you're saying.
Yes,
that's
great
his Secret
point.
Service
yeah.
name. It's yeah. interesting. Gail sent us a message from her iPhone. He should be able to keep it, but he should use an iPhone instead because he's all about change.
Yeah.
That's funny, but brings up an interesting point that even this issue is going to be an issue for whomever is president from now on. He is, it's 2.0 presidency. There are going to be laptops and BlackBerries and cell phones. So this, in a way, is an issue that it's not going to go away.
No, and he's already decided, apparently, according to the New York Times, that he will have a desktop computer in the Oval Office for the first time in history. And so he's already made it clear that he's going to have, some access via computer to the outside world. We don't know whether that will just be internet access or whether he'll have email that he uses from the Oval Office. But he's not going to be shut down entirely. I think it would be a really bad sign if a president was. It was actually something that was raised as a campaign issue about John McCain. I thought it was a totally legitimate issue that he was not online. In the 21st
right.
century, your president has to be online.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're speaking with Jonathan Alter from Newsweek magazine about whether or not President-elect Barack Obama should have to surrender his BlackBerry, which has been suggested to him for security reasons, but also for reasons about the Presidential Records Act, the idea that people would have access to these communications after, I believe it's 12 years, right?
But I don't see why email should be treated any differently than snail mail is by Presidential Records Act. There's a process by which the president's correspondence is declassified and released to the public, and they can just apply that process to his emails. It'll be difficult for historians because there'll be thousands of emails to go through, but that's their problem.
Not his. Let's go to Alan in Cleveland. Hi, Alan.
Hi. It seems that we've got to be able to trust the President of the United States to be able to control flow of communications both in and out and make responsible decisions in terms of what he sends. And if he's getting email that's not appropriate, then cut it off. But if he can't make these decisions, don't we have other issues?
That's a good point, Alan. Thanks a lot. I want to follow that up with Laurel from Michigan wrote this. She's from Michigan, remember. If Mr. Obama does keep his BlackBerry, I suggest he at least take a lesson on what not to do from former Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick.
That's harsh.
That is harsh. People need to remember that Kwame Kilpatrick was caught having an affair via messages on his BlackBerry, right? That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
We're not suggesting anything about that with the Obamas, of course.
Nothing, that's the thing about Obama. You know, there just haven't even been any rumors in that department.
No. So but it's the idea that you become so... Yeah, the idea, though, is you become so comfortable with your BlackBerry that you might type something that you probably, you know, wouldn't say in conversation or it slips out of your mouth.
He's been using it, you know, all throughout the campaign with any number of friends, and there hasn't been any indication of him being... indiscreet. As I said, what he mostly says is "Go White Sox," and thank you for the email. So he's a pretty disciplined guy, and I don't think that's something that we're going to have to worry about too much. And also, we need to make it clear he has not made a decision on this yet. I was just urging that when he does make a decision, he decide to keep it. And I think it is really important for him to have all kinds of different views, to pierce that bubble we've been talking about, pierce that isolation. Some of it is from his aides, from experts, yes, even from polling to show some of what the American people are thinking, from books, from all kinds of places. You want him to have an open mind as he moves forward.
It's been suggested by one of our listeners it's now be called a BarackBerry. We're going to Jason in Phoenix. Jason, you say there's a bigger issue here. It should be about symbolism.
Well, yeah, it's symbolism because Obama, he's kind of someone that my generation, a younger generation, latches onto. He embraces technology. He's forward-thinking. And I got to throw this out there. It's a little short little story, but I'll get it out as quick as I can.
You got 20
on
seconds.
On 9/11, I was awake, and I watched the second plane hit the towers live. Mm. Immediately, I started paging, texting, and emailing people. I had emailed at least six people and talked to them on the phone. By the time the president was made aware of it, I saw that on TV. Now, this is the reason I didn't vote for McCain, is because McCain said he doesn't even know how to use a computer.
Right.
So when I say he should keep it, and he should be allowed to keep it and use it, because it shows that we need to embrace technology and be forward-thinking in the way we do things.
Jason from Arizona, thank you for sharing that story. Jonathan Alter is a senior editor and columnist for Newsweek magazine and the author of the book on President-elect Obama's Nightstand, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. You joined us from our New York bureau. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Allison.
You can find his op-ed, Keep the BlackBerry, on our website, npr.org/talk. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington.